A recent exhibition at UMSL's Gallery 210 that explores the history of St. Louis as the first major type design city in the Midwest will reopen to the public for one day on June 25th for a closing reception and the release of the exhibition's catalog. St. Louis On the Air contributor Steve Potter has more on cast and recast St. Louis type design, present and past.
The exhibition at Gallery 210 was a look back at a time when St. Louis was a hotbed of creativity for type design. The exhibition also examined how type is designed today and had some other elements as well. Please welcome Jennifer McKnight. She's the Associate Professor of Graphic Design at the University of Missouri St. Louis Department of Art and Art History. And Gallery 210 is also located on the UMSL campus. Jennifer, nice to see you again.
Good afternoon.
And Ben Keel is a type designer for Type Founding. Ben, nice to meet you.
Good afternoon.
And on the phone from his home in Wisconsin, Robert Mullen. He's the author of Recasting a Craft, St. Louis Type Founders Respond to Industrialization. And we welcome him.
Hello.
And I know, Bob, you were affiliated with the Missouri History Museum for quite some time here in St. Louis.
Right. I worked there for 24 years. I was the collections manager and worked with the objects collection primarily.
Well, Bob, this is 2016. I don't guess most people think about type and its importance to our history. What would you say to that?
Well, type is really quite important to our history because if we look back, going back to Gutenberg, who invented the process of printing as we know it, it was an invention that really changed how we look at the world. It was an invention that allowed us to print and preserve man's thoughts and distribute it in a mass way to many, many people. And because of that, his invention of type and printing with it allowed us to preserve much of what mankind has learned over the centuries.
Mm-hmm. Ben Keel, you are a type designer today. So can you just tell us a little bit about the business that you have here?
I'm a typeface designer here in St. Louis. I work with a lot of foundries around the world. My client base, depending on who I'm working with, ranges from New Zealand to London. What I do is I make typefaces for sale, for branding, for other uses, depending on the client. Most of what I do is custom for a specific need.
So would it be safe to say that maybe typefacing is a bigger business than most of us would suspect?
Yeah, that's one of the great things about lots of things in graphic design is a lot of the work that graphic designers do, we don't necessarily see. We feel them. So if Ben makes a custom typeface for a client, you don't necessarily see, oh, that's a typeface that's different. You say, wow, this brand gives me a certain feeling. It's a way of influencing and creating an experience that we don't necessarily see, but we always feel mm-hmm. and experience.
And Bob, St. Louis played a very important part in the history of this. Were there specific reasons that it was St. Louis?
Well, St. Louis wasn't the only important type founding city in this country, but when St. Louis began growing, a type foundry began in as early as 1840, and over the rest of the 19th century, several other type foundries formed, and it was some of these type foundries that became quite creative in creating a lot of new typefaces. And I'm not talking about necessarily typefaces just for books, but towards the end of the century, advertising became very important, and they started designing all these, oh, some of these wild and fancy typefaces that you associate with the 19th century. And probably between St. Louis foundries and those in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, most of the new typefaces for advertising were created in the last half of the 19th century.
Help me understand something. When I think of looking at printed words today, I don't see, at least not consciously, very much variation in type styles. So was that a lot different 100 and odd years ago?
I think the ones he's talking about really were. They were really fancy ones that we might associate with, you know, fancy invitations to the World's Fair or beautiful type you'd see carved on the side of a building or some of the stuff that's maybe in stained glass in St. Louis.
But you work in this today, Ben.
Yeah, I would say actually that there's a pretty wide range in what is normal to us today would seem very exotic to someone from the 19th century. And what the typefaces that were created in St. Louis and other places in the 19th century to support advertising, which looked to us very old-fashioned or very sort of unusual, were normal and people were used to it. So there's a phrase that we read best what we read the most. The thing is, German newspapers in America up until the 1940s were still printed in blackletter, which is if I gave you a page of blackletter or Fraktur to read now, you would really not like me. Because it's very hard to read.
It's very distracting
and very hard to read if you're not used to it. The visual culture and environment we live in, we do a lot of reading today. It is primarily moved to screen, but we're looking at type and printed words or words on screen all the time. And the tone that is set from what we read, part of that tone is the content and part of it is the form. And the selection of a typeface for that form provides a tone.
Jennifer, so the exhibition Cast and Recast St. Louis Type, Present and Past was put together primarily for the role that it played here in St. Louis. So we're talking about a time period roughly 1840 to 1920. So could you all talk a little bit about that here? I mean, was there a type center? Was it a geographical location or how did it happen?
Well, what I've kind of gathered from the research I've done in the last year is, I mean, one of the things that was really significant at that period is we were a big rail hub and a big commerce hub in terms of the Mississippi River trade at that time. In Robert's book, he articles that at that point, there's a lot of problems with supply and demand. Lots of newspapers were opening in that time period because a lot of people wanted to read. There were all these new Americans coming from Europe, and they wanted to express their nationalism by reading English. And so there was this huge demand for papers, and these papers needed newspapers, and these newspapers needed type. But during the Civil War, sometimes those supply trains were broken down. And so if St. Louis had stuff, then you could print papers. And when it didn't have the materials, it couldn't. So if you had a type foundry in town, then you always had your type.
Yeah, Bob, I'm wondering, too, this was back in the time, too, right, when type was sent one letter at a time. I can't imagine what kind of time was required to put out a newspaper or something else. Can you shed a little light on that?
Well, sure. For a newspaper, of course, it depends on whether it was a weekly newspaper or a daily newspaper. The daily newspapers in St. Louis began, I believe, if I remember right, in the 1840s or 1830s or so. But you had a small army of typesetters in order to set enough type for a daily newspaper. If it was a weekly paper and a small rural paper, well, you know, a couple people working in the shop could get that done in a week. But yeah, it took a lot of type and a lot of time to set one letter at a time to fill out a whole paper.
What I've always liked about typeface design is its intersection with culture, language, and history. And at this period of time, type and typesetting technology was sort of a high-tech industry, what we would think of as a startup company today. Typesetting, the manufacture, production of type, or coming up with the linotype or monotype machines for typesetting to speed up the process, because you would have to have, for a daily newspaper, a whole army of people. That was high-tech back then. And just as we see companies merging, all sorts of stuff, today, the same thing happened in the type industry. At one point, what I really actually appreciate about St. Louis type design history is that at one point, all the type foundries in America, for the most part, merged into ATF, American Type Founders. Only two companies were acquired for cash, and that was Central and Boston. And that was it. Everyone else was stock. What I also love about that story is that the sons of the owners of Central then took that money and started a competitor, which was then again bought by ATF. So things that we think are very sort of dot-com era today, it's nothing new. And
These were the tech companies
of the day.
We see the pattern repeating.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's one of the stories I really appreciate in Bob's book.
Yeah, and Bob, in that book of yours, Recasting a Craft, you describe three distinct periods of the industry here in St. Louis.
Right. Well, the first part would be beginning with 1840, the St. Louis Type Foundry started producing type mainly for newspapers and periodicals. And they sold advertising type that was made by other companies farther east. And that would be take us up to around the Civil War or shortly after. After the Civil War, as the population of St. Louis and the West began expanding immensely, there was a lot more demand for the products of the type foundry. So we see another major type foundry beginning about 1870, the Central Type Foundry, and that led up to the 1892 formation of American Type Founders, ATF. So the third period would be the sons of the Straubstadters, the sons of the Central Type Foundry founder, starting up the Inland Type Foundry and a couple other foundries that were begun after that, too. So it's before the Civil War, you know, post-Civil War to about 1890s, and then beyond that, the foundries had formed to compete against the large American Type Founders Company and gave them real strong competition, enough that American Type Founders had to buy them out eventually.
I'm interested because you also profile the workers, and I'm curious about who these workers were. Were these low-paying jobs and they worked too many hours, or was this a respected field or what?
Well, there's both, really. If you were a person who actually cast the type, or if you did the engraving, or did one of the technical jobs, then you were fairly well paid, at least as much as any other technical job in the city would have been. There were also a small army of lesser paid workers, women and children, and lower paid jobs that didn't take any special skills. They could be trained to do it, and they would work, what was typical that era, 12-hour days, 5 days a week, and often another 6 hours on Saturday. So, yeah, there were both fairly decently paid ones, but then probably more of the workers who didn't do a skilled job were paid what we might call today minimum wage.
Uh-huh. Jennifer and Ben, how much printed material from this period that we're talking about is still around today and has been preserved? And also, how much of the original, I don't know, printing presses and the other machinery and technology of the time, how much of that still exists?
Well, it's interesting that you ask about, especially about the printing presses, the letter presses. In the 2000s, the letter press, there's been a huge revival of the letter press movement, and they're made for artistic purposes, and they've become very, very valuable. They're becoming more and more rare, and presses like Firecracker Press run sort of beautiful high-end advertisements on them now and have driven a demand for new metal type to run on these letter presses.
I would say in terms of the printed material, there's plenty. You know, type designers are always chasing down specimen books, and the catalogs and the things from foundries exist. The ephemera, the posters that were printed, some it depends, but a lot of that exists. In terms of the equipment by the manufacturers, most of that is gone.
Mm-hmm. The St. Louis Public Library actually has one of the better collections of the type foundry catalogs in the country from the 19th and early 20th century, with over 100 different ones, and plus another 20 or 30 from European type foundries. And these were all, or mostly of them, were collected by one of the Central Type Foundry's main characters, Nicholas Werner, who actually worked with the composition of the catalogs that Central put out. And he collected these over a number of years, and eventually he donated them to the St. Louis Public Library.
Another part of the Cast and Recast exhibition was that you included some art from current artists, posters and things. Tell me about that. And some of them were political posters.
This was probably my favorite part of this exhibition. The funnest part was history's really great, but living history's even better. And so that's where Ben Keel comes in. He designed for us a type revival of a typeface, geometric italic, which was designed for Central Type Foundry in the 1800s. So when we made this new typeface for the exhibition, or Ben did, we wanted to show it off. And that's the whole point of a type specimen. A specimen is anything that you'd use to show off your typeface and show all the things it can do. And so we asked for area designers to help us out with this project, and they designed political posters for us that were type specimens to show off this new typeface, geometric italic.
Ben, do you have a favorite?
There are picking favorites is like picking your favorite child, because I know many of the designers. But
I was impressed how wide and how many things they explored in this set of posters.
Yeah, there's a huge range. Audra Hubble did a wonderful one about climate change. What's nice for me, actually, is as a type designer, my world is spent staring at black and white shapes most of the day. And to see your type, the thing that you've been spending a lot of time with, live in other people's hands and see it in color and see it used in ways that you wouldn't expect, only informs your design and the changes you might want to make. So the huge range of what people did, Audra's is great. Marco
Cheatham.
Cheatham's is fantastic.
There's a really nice one by Lynn Ullman where she's exploring the idea of the Del Mar Divide. Really beautiful.
Range of topics was great. Yeah.
So Cast and Recast is going to reopen the exhibition for one day?
Yes. Come see it. We have one more opportunity to come see this show. It's 5 to 7 on June 25th. Open to the public. We would really love to see you out at Gallery 210.
And that's when the catalog will come out?
Yes, and we are releasing a catalog with all the posters and the timeline and articles by Ben and Robert and myself about the exhibition.
One final question for you all. What do we gain from understanding and appreciating the history of type? Ben Keel.
We gain an understanding of how the printed word has spread. So we understand how we have a culture that communicates in a permanent form.
Jennifer McKnight.
For me, it's an opportunity to really understand what our opportunities are as St. Louisans and Missourians, what's special about living here in this time right now, and what opportunities we have by looking at the opportunities that those type designers took in the 1800s through the 1910s, and the situations are repeating.
And Bob Mullen, a final thought?
Well, I like to think of the fancy types that were done by the St. Louis foundries in the 19th century. And when you look at those advertising types that they put out in those days and compare them to the advertising you might see today, you can see that they were really forerunners of what we're doing today in advertising. And you can either congratulate them on what they did, or you can blame them for all the advertising that you see today.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Steve Potter speaking with Robert Mullen, author of Recasting a Craft, St. Louis Type Founders Respond to Industrialization. Jennifer McKnight, Associate Professor of Graphic Design at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And Ben Keel, Type Designer with Type Founding. The exhibition Cast and Recast, St. Louis Type Design, Present and Past, will reopen for a closing reception from 5 until 7 p.m. on Saturday, June 25th at Umsel's Gallery 210. The catalog for the exhibition will also be released at that time. More information is available at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Kim Oswalt, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.